Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Oh, my name is Kirsten Ellsworth, and I am a host for the Art Channel on the New Books Network, New Books in Art. And today I am very much looking forward to speaking with the co-editors and a contributor for a very recently published book, Unsettling Native Art Histories on the Northwest Coast, published by the University of Washington Press in 2020. And the Bill Holmes Center for the Study of Northwest Native Art, Burke Museum in Seattle. I would like to start our conversation today by having our participants introduce themselves so we know a little bit about the complexity and all the different voices that came into this book. So let's hear from the participants.
Well, hi, Kristen. It's wonderful to be here today. Thank you so much for inviting all of us. I'm Katie Bunn-Marcuse, and I'm a settler scholar who lives in the Coast Salish Territory, specifically in Seattle on Duwamish Territory, and also the shared lands and waters of the Suquamish, Muckleshoot, Tulalip nations. And so I am the curator of Northwest Native Art at the Burke Museum, the director of the Bill Holmes Center for the Study of Northwest Native Art, and an assistant professor in the Art History Department. And was really overjoyed to co-edit this book with Aldona Genitis. And I'm so glad that we have one of our contributors, Sharon Fortney, with us today. And I look forward to talking more about the book.
Katie, maybe you could give us a brief bio on Aldona since her audio is a little off.
So Aldona Genitis is one of the leading scholars in our field. And she has been involved in the field of Northwest Coast art history for many decades. She is the director emerita of the University of Alaska Museum of the North. Her PhD is from Columbia University. She was a professor and an administrator at Stony Brook University, and also vice president at the American Museum of Natural History, where she put on such formative exhibits as chiefly feasts, which was about the Kwakwaka'wakw potlatch collection there. And she has other important books, Art of the Northwest Coast, which is being currently republished in a new edition by University of Washington Press, and a great book called The Totem Pole, An Intercultural History, which was edited with Aaron Glass. And she's currently working on a book about contemporary Tlingit artists.
Thank you. And Sharon, will you introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name is Sharon Fortney. I'm the curator of Indigenous Collections and Engagement at the Museum of Vancouver in Canada. And I have Klahus and German ancestry, Klahus being Northern Coast Salish First Nation. And so I've been working in the Vancouver area for many years in the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. And I'm just really happy to be invited to come and speak with you today.
Well, we're really happy to have you, all of you here. And let's start by asking what motivated you to bring this book to life?
Well, this book started at actually a conference in 2017 at the Native American Art Studies Association, which we call NASA, conference in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And there were several sessions on Northwest Coast art history, new research in the field, that were hosted and led by Aldona Genitis. And at the end of those sessions, Aldona and I were talking, and we were just talking about how different this conference felt in terms of the research that was being presented, and that we felt that maybe this was the moment to put out a new book on research in Northwest Coast art history. And so many of the contributors to this book presented in that original conference, but it's not just that. It was, we opened it up to many other contributors who are working across the Northwest Coast, looking for a real diversity of voices, people who are coming from their jobs in museums, but also their positions in community as community historians, artists who were writing not about their own practice, but writing as experts in their own fields, being mostly women, but also some men who know about the cultural and aesthetic heritage of their community. And so we brought all of those people together, and that's how this book came about.
As a contributor, Sharon, would you like to add anything about what made you want to contribute to the volume?
Well, I was recently hired, I think, at the Museum of Vancouver when I was invited to participate in the project. And so I thought it was a nice way to bring attention to the Museum of Vancouver's collection, which had been kind of hidden from the public for many years, the Indigenous belongings that are at that museum. So I saw it as a really good way to raise some awareness about that collection. And to talk about some of the reconciliation principles that the museum was trying to enact at the time.
As a reader of the book, I would like to say that what Katie and Sharon are talking about is so strongly present in the book. You have such a diverse group of voices, people involved with collections, artists. It's a much thicker tapestry, or it's such a well-developed tapestry. And maybe I could ask you, in the introduction to the book, you mentioned that there are current ethics in your field, and you've alluded to the, you know, there are ethical issues. And one that I thought was really striking, which I think you've referred to, is that Indigenous artists, scholars, and communities are the experts on their own histories. Could you talk to us a little bit more about this position that you're taking in the book and in your own work?
Sure, I'll start, and then I think Sharon can probably bring in some wonderful examples from the Museum of Vancouver. So we wanted to note that this is one of the things that not only do all of us who work in the field understand now as new practice, but that we really saw this come out in the papers and in the work from people who were invited to contribute to the book. And as in many fields where academia has engaged with communities that have lived under colonialism, oftentimes their histories have been either filtered through white academic voices, often male, or just entirely interpreted by them. And so we wanted to show that the current ethics in our field recognize this fact that the Indigenous artists and scholars and communities are the experts, and that our job, if you are a non-Native scholar, is to work very carefully with community in collaboration, with respect, in relationships. And really, if you're working with older archival pieces, to work with community members to make sure that you can put those in the proper historical and Indigenously informed context to bring that material forward.
Sure.
So Sharon, do you want to pitch in maybe with some particular examples
sure.
from museums in terms
of in Canada,
you know,
right
the collection?
Yeah. And in Canada right now, I would also like to add, like, there's a big trend right now towards hiring Indigenous curators. And being in one of those roles myself, I find there's a tendency for people to expect you to be able to speak to all Indigenous issues, you know, sometimes without the consultation that's required. And I just like to say that positioning is really important, and being aware of what you should and shouldn't speak to. like, I'm very comfortable talking about my family history, but when it comes to working in Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh territory, how do I speak about the collections and the belongings? I have to really, you know, be mindful of how I'm representing somebody else's history. So I think positioning is really important. And I think that comes through in the book as well, where we're seeing more Indigenous scholars, curators, writers, speaking to their own communities, and giving a balance to that sense of identity that was missing in the past. Whereas, you know, identity, Michael Ames always used to say, was, you know, how you see yourself, but also how others see you. And for so long, there's been an imbalance in how identity, Indigenous identity, has been portrayed, you know, with the outside view being given more emphasis than the internal view. So I like the balance that this book is bringing to Indigenous art history on the Northwest Coast.
As a reader, I was struck by just described as balance. And I also felt I was sort of had in my hand something a little bit radical, because I got to read first person accounts and learn about families and hear things presented, as you said, from an insider's points of view. And I think for those who are interested in this field, the book really does challenge some concepts with which a lot of art historians and others are just too familiar. And with that said, I wondered if you could explain some of the concepts that drive the analysis, in particular settler colonization and decolonization, and how those themes frame the project.
Sure. I can take a stab at that. So settler colonialism is a particular historical and social formation of colonialism, so characterized by outsiders who claim Indigenous land as their own, right? So that's the settlers. And it's an ongoing system of power. And it still exists. It perpetuates the damage that has been done and continues to happen under settler occupation. We can look at the exploitation of land and natural resources on the territories that Indigenous people have their long genealogical and long land relationships with. And so the book really asks the question of how do we unsettle art history, or particularly in this case, Native art history on the Northwest Coast. And so from my perspective, is as a settler scholar, is that that means I have to change the kind of relationship that academics have sometimes had with Indigenous communities and take direction from people within communities themselves. So as a curator, I do this, but also as an academic researcher. And so that kind of unsettling can take a bunch of different forms. It can take the form of re-examining previous scholarship, that's not a new thing for art history or any historians. Of course, that's an established part of scholarly practice. But the unsettling work is that you have to be actively aware of the both past and then the ongoing effects of settler colonialism. So that means you have to really listen and learn and act in ways that respect and uphold Indigenous priorities. And so that's really sort of the new call. And hopefully the book reflects some of that.
I'll add to that.
I would say most definitely for those who are going to read the book, yes.
Oh,
Sharon,
I was just going to add a little bit about decolonizing museums. And I think the work that I've been doing at the Museum of Vancouver, we're working on that on a number of fronts. Like, it's not just about, you know, having Indigenous people tell their own stories in the exhibitions, but also about providing access to the collection, whether it's physical access to come into the storage room and spend time with the belongings, or whether it's digitizing the collection and making it accessible on the website so people can see what's there. And also another way we're trying to decolonize our museum is to have Indigenous representatives on our board of directors. So since I've been at the museum, we've actually recruited board members from each of our host nations. So about a quarter of the board is now Indigenous. And that really helps, I think, to challenge and question things that we would normally take for granted in how we operate our institution, to find other ways of doing things and to make the museum more accessible. And one other way we do that also is through complimentary admission to self-identifying Indigenous people, so that people who have been denied access to their heritage, you know, they don't have to pay to come in and see it in our galleries.
To return to something both have mentioned about power dynamics, the examples of changing the board and the access to the collections are such important ways to actually make a powerful shift, not just to talk about a change. And maybe we could talk a little bit now about some of the art that that you cover in the book with all these diverse contributors. And maybe that, I think the question of, and it goes right through the academic history and everything, this concept of replication that you discuss in the book, and whether non-Native artists should make Native-styled art, and how that's played out in our understandings. Would you address that topic of replication?
Well, I wish that we could hear Aldona, because she and Janet Berlow were the authors for that particular chapter. This is a history, particularly in Seattle, that's been very difficult. There have been a lot of non-Native carvers carving in Northwest Coast style in Seattle. And it's has been an interesting situation over the years. Some of it grew out of close relationships with Indigenous communities where non-Native artists were working closely, and some still do and spend a lot of time teaching and mentoring, learning they had learned from older carvers in community, and are really involved in respectful and reciprocal relationships. There are other situations in which non-Native artists and carvers and others are benefiting and taking market share, making money on other people's cultural aesthetics. And that is really an affront to the people whose aesthetic systems this are. And it's taking money out of the market. And it's something that in the United States, there is a law that demands that galleries identify who is an Indigenous artist and who is not. There isn't a similar law in Canada, but there's actually a much stronger public and, I think, community pressure to keep non-Native artists from taking this Indigenous heritage as their own. So on the one hand, there have been some idiosyncratic particular situations where communities have been all right with some of these people. And for the most part, this has become a large problem, particularly across Canada and in the United States, of appropriation on a large and small commercial scale.
Sure. Sharon, I would add that we're talking about it as though it's just art. And often there's other things at play with Indigenous, like visual expression. Like there can be like stories, intellectual property, things that pass through families or clans or belong to specific communities that, you know, are not necessarily public knowledge to everyone. And so we sort of, I'm not expressing this very well, but what I guess I'm trying to say is that if we just look at it as copying or, you know, art, it's not just art sometimes. There's intangible heritage involved in it. So it's actually taking something from the community and using it in a way that it isn't intended without really knowing the full story behind it or having the right to tell that story. So I think it's an intellectual property issue on a large scale that people are objecting to when we see Indigenous, non-Indigenous artists recreating Indigenous artworks and designs.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And related, something I was very interested in the book is the way that there might have been a construct that there was a sort of a rebirth of Indigenous cultural practices, visually based, as you're saying, Sharon, after a decline, and that somehow this setup was proposed and drove more production of more objects. Would you speak to that, either of you, this Renaissance idea?
In Canada, I would say like there was a big resurgence of cultural identity in the 70s after the federal government released the White Paper, which basically declared Indigenous people in Canada to be assimilated. So there was a real big pushback from communities in response to that White Paper. There was a Red Paper, and then there was like a sort of a resurgence in Indigenous cultural education practices throughout the province. And we saw, like on the coast, we saw places like Kasan School pop up, where printmaking and other new forms of cultural production started to emerge. I think that people were ready to take back what they felt they had lost at that time. And so people were actually going to museums and using the collections to study, to bring back some art forms that were lost. And we see that in Vancouver with Coast Salish art in particular, where it was kind of silenced for many, many years. And there was a powerful exhibition in the 1980s at the Museum of Anthropology that was curated by Michael Q. And he studied Coast Salish collections around the world. And he took photographs and documentation and brought them back to the Vancouver area. And artists like the Musqueam artist Susan Point were able to access those slides and study these older belongings all around the world. And initially through copying, as prints or other media, they started to understand that style again. And now you see we're in a period where people are very comfortable now with that style of artwork, and we're seeing it flourish and go in new directions, which I think is really exciting.
And I would jump in with a little bit more background, particularly for American audiences who do not necessarily have the historical background, that in Canada, the potlatch was outlawed from 1885 to 1951. And that was a time the potlatch was a system of governance and also ceremony. And it was the context for a lot of the ceremonial arts on the Northwest Coast to be made and used. And because it was actively prosecuted and people from some parts of the coast went to jail, that system was not allowed to be in place. Now, in some places, it continued underground. People found other very resilient ways to carry on their stories, their ceremonies, their beliefs. But in other ways, it was it hugely damaged the ability to carry those things on. The boarding schools that were put in place that abused children and kept them from speaking their language. All of these things put huge pressure on the making of arts and that traditional mentorship process and the context for using art within community. And so, as Sharon's talking about, when the potlatch ban was dropped in the early 1950s and people started to potlatch again, and then you move into this resurgence of the 70s and after that Sharon mentioned, you do get a sense of that there was less art making in some communities, the understanding of what those traditional aesthetics for years and years, and their connection to all of the intangible property that Sharon mentioned, those things were under great pressure. And there was great damage done. And in the 70s and then the late 20th century, and continuing on to today, you see such a huge blossoming of that. You see kids who now are able to grow up in the big house or within ceremony, learning from their elders who had been part of that boarding school and potlatch persecution time. But things are not perfect, but certainly much different today. And there is a huge resurgence of artwork. And as Sharon said, the Salish has been incredibly underappreciated, and that's coming back in huge ways. And in Washington, if you move down to the Columbia River, that was also a area where Northwest Coast art really was very much ignored and considered to be less than. And now that is also coming back with a number of really important artists and large public commissions and also community use on the Columbia River as well.
It's encouraging. And I think readers will really catch the connection between the different times that you're describing and how now we have, through this book, a methodology for making sure that research matches practices. And there's a significant part of the book devoted to gender. And I wondered if you would speak about how maybe the colonial definitions of gender impacted arts and how that might be changing as the process of decolonization takes place.
That is a really important part of this book. A part of Northwest Coast art history that I'm really devoted to supporting. And women's artistic creations are highly treasured and valued within First Nations communities on the Northwest Coast. And yet they've been long discounted by collectors and scholars. And one of the reasons for that is because of the patriarchal and Eurocentric conceptions of what is great art, right? So those categories have often been described as painting, sculpture, and architecture, as you well know, Kristen. And those categories aligned quite well with the public arts on the northern Northwest Coast. So the large totem poles, painted house fronts, carved boxes, even masks, those things aligned well with the Western conceptions of great art, and they were widely collected by early anthropologists and museum expeditions. And so what happens is there's an incredible ripple effect from that. A vast majority of collections are based on men's productions. The vast majority of research, and particularly any names we know of artists from the past, are attached to those men's productions. And then what happens is that when exhibits and publications come out of those collections, it makes it look as if the majority of creations were made by men in those communities. When, if you go to any gathering, perhaps the raising of a totem pole, for instance, you will see there is the totem pole and the big house, but everything everyone is wearing is made by the women in their community.
One part of the book that I found so interesting, and I know readers will want to hear more about, is the section on gender. And I'm wondering if you could speak to one of the main points I extrapolated, which is that colonial definitions of male and female gender roles really impacted the collection of and understanding of, for example, the Haida art and Indigenous art overall?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's definitely something we wanted to address in the book. We have a whole section where Nika Collison and Lou Ann Neal discuss the exhibition of women's art at the Haida Gwaii Museum, or the creations that Lou Ann Neal's grandmother, Ellen Neal, made. And it's really important to think about what the colonial impact is and has been on art making on the Northwest Coast. So for us, we wanted to re-center women in these artistic histories and make that a critical part of the book. So one of the things we were thinking about is the fact that the patriarchal conceptions of great art that exist in European, Euro-American art history, things like the understanding that the great arts are painting, sculpture, and architecture, really impacted what people collected on the Northwest Coast in the late 19th and early 20th century and before that. And that really favored men's creations, and particularly on the northern Northwest Coast, where there was a tradition of big public male-created, for the most part, artwork in terms of totem poles, house fronts, house screens, that really aligned with what Western collectors thought of as the great arts. And so that meant those are the things that filled museums. They are also then the things that went on exhibit, which meant they were then the things that were put into publications. And particularly before the internet, those publications were all of the historical records that people had to understand art on the Northwest Coast. And so we wanted to address the fact that on the Northwest Coast, men's and women's arts exist in balance. And actually, you can't really have one without the other. You can't raise a totem pole without a public ceremony. You can't have, people can't participate without being dressed correctly for that occasion. It's really important that you show up wearing, whether it's the Chilkat robes or the button blankets or aprons or all of the things that women make that are essential to those kinds of moments. And so we know that that historical bias against women exists in collections and in the publication records. And we really wanted to address that in the book.
And with that said, how do you feel this element of your methodology and what is presented in the book is this appealing? I would think the answer is yes, but I'd like to hear more. Is this appealing to contemporary artists, men and women?
Well, I think so, because I think it's really important as we go back and we look through the historical record and through those museum collections, which, while they were centered a lot on men's work, do have the work of women, although they don't have as much collection information, people's names, where they came from, those things. But it's important when we look through all those records, we actually do see that women were making things beyond what the colonial definitions of sort of the gender boundaries were. So some women were carving back in the day. And that is very liberating, particularly for women now who are getting much more interested in carving. And to understand that the gender expectations of art making were really calcified by the imposition of the patriarchal colonial system. And also, we know that, you know, women were always in the middle of all of the planning in the community. They were really holding a lot of those histories and passing them on to their children. And so women really helped to create and shape the cultural framework, even on the aspects of public art that was expressed by both men and women.
We have the privilege of meeting right now with Aldona Janitis, who is the co-editor of the book. And Aldona, would you introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Hi there. Thank you so much for inviting me. My name is Aldona Janitis, and I am the retired director of the University of Alaska Museum of the North. And I have worked on Northwest Coast art since the 1970s. So I have a very long overview of the history of the discipline. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to work with Katie with this book, because so much has changed over the last 50 years in the scholarship of Northwest Coast art.
As you look at the changes, do you feel encouraged by the different methodologies and approaches?
It's really interesting. It's a good question, because I come, and in my last essay, the last essay in the book, is my essay looking over the last 50 years of Northwest Coast scholarship from the perspective of somebody who has lived through it and attempted to change over the years as the discipline changed. And I must say, the future could only be even better than it is now, because it used to be a very white-oriented, very patriarchal type of discipline that looked to what they called then traditional Northwest Coast art, i.e. art of basically the 19th century, as the authentic art of the of Northwest Coast Native people. This is not unique to the Northwest Coast, but now the notion that the past was authentic and the present is inauthentic is absolutely bunk. And so we're looking now at art from the past from a different perspective, which is privileging the Aboriginal voice for their interpretations of that, and accepting what's going on today as extraordinarily important expressions of contemporary Northwest Coast life and art. And one of the things that I'm personally most thrilled about is the new openness to female art, because when I studied Northwest Coast art I wrote a PhD about Tlingit art in the 70s. I wasn't expected to put any basketry in there, very little textile other than Chilkat robes, and you just didn't do women's art. Now, the notion that women have a very important say in the history, and also that women's art embodies a whole different sphere of meaning, i.e. the meaning of nature, the cycle of nature, the complementarity of a woman's role and a man's role. These are all elements within women's art that are so full of significance and meaning that in the past, when you had only male anthropologists studying this, they never even asked the question. So I am so optimistic about what the future is going to be in this discipline, because we can only go further.
It's so encouraging. And in the beginning of our conversation today, the other editor of the book and one of the contributors were talking about what motivated them to participate in the project. And as we think about the importance of this book in the field, I wonder if you could talk to us about your hopes for the impact of the book, and you're a strong force in the project. So what are your hopes for the book?
Okay. It's an interesting question, because it goes once again back to my history. I'm a child of the 60s. And at that point, people like me and colleagues and students, friends, had an ethical commitment to, promoting racial equality and promoting trying to get knowledge in the general public of the cultural achievements of Indigenous people. Now, let's just put aside the fact that that is a there are issues, contemporary issues, with that kind of attitude. But and as the time went on, I kept on saying, how can I do the most ethical scholarship for my own values? And I think that the notion of ethical scholarship, and I think Katie really talked a lot about this very eloquently. Ethical scholarship treats everybody as very equal, and they have an equal voice, and Indigenous people have an even more authority to talk about a lot of the aspects of the art. And these are all ethical issues that have now become ingrained in the discipline, and that is something that is just a thrill to see, because not only are scholars who have been and continue to be leftist and have this as part of their soul, but it's just become what people do. and how people think about this. And that's a sea change. It's in sea change in anthropology and art history. And that is embodied in the essays in the book.
I think that listeners will hear your point about pursuing research that matches your values and should be encouraged and provoked to think about that in their own work. Yes. I think that's a very empowering comment. And maybe we could ask you what your future projects are.
Well, I live in Alaska. I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska, and the Tlingit live in Southeast Alaska. And I did my dissertation on them, and they went to various other communities. And the Tlingit are a very large ethnic group in Alaska, or large tribal group in Alaska. And there are so many contemporary Tlingit artists who are making a very large range of different kinds of art in a contemporary mode, in a mode that reflects the past. And so my work with collaborating with two people, Chris Green, who's a very young PhD in art history, and Ishmael Hope, who's a young Tlingit cultural leader and a writer. We are three writing a book about contemporary Tlingit art. And I think the most important part of it is every artist that is represented in the book is going to be asked to choose his or her favorite piece and then write about it. And so the book will not only be edited by us, but also there will be 40 essays or selections by Indigenous artists speaking in their own voice. And I think that's kind of, you know, I have the ability to edit things and to get things through. I'm a natural born administrator. And my job there is to back up very, very much, use my knowledge of the history of Tlingit art to add a historical dimension to this, but give a framework for other Indigenous people to speak about the things that matter to them. And that, I think, is the way non-Native scholars today are making the best of their position and how they can, and the best way to proceed in this very exciting discipline. And the other thing about Northwest Coast art, I just have to tell you, I've been understood, it's gorgeous. It's fabulous art. I know that's something that is also, you know, pretty Western, but I love it. I started off talking about, you know, writing about it because it was so beautiful. And I think a lot of the artists today would agree with me that the past and the present and the future of the art is very beautiful.
I just feel excited about seeing this book when it comes to fruition. Just, I'm imagining the illustrations in the book, and also as I'm listening, the principles that all of you put into play in unsettling Native art histories on the Northwest Coast, which we've been talking about today, are clearly spinning off another life in your next project. And that is very exciting. And Aldona, I really want to thank you for joining us from Alaska today. And all of you have been terrific conversationalists. I know readers are going to be really interested in the book. And again, thank you.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.